Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, episode 149. Today's going to be a fun and exciting episode. You know, when we started this podcast over 3 years ago, we were looking for this idea of ordinary to extraordinary people who their path in life wasn't as certain as it might seem. At the end of the story, it's always a little bit easier because things look good. But, you know, throughout, I think is what we love to hear, the stories of people and their journey. I had the pleasure of meeting Mark a couple of weeks ago at an Ironman race. And Mark is the consummate example of, you know, that there's never really an end, right? There's always opportunity, no matter how bad it gets. Mark wrote about it in his book, which we'll talk about. He just finished another Ironman. The guy has figured out how to pull himself up from the bootstraps every day and make this into a good life, no matter how hard it got. So, Mark, welcome to the podcast. Pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. And it's an absolute honor to hear somebody, share how they perceive me in that light, right? Because that is not new to me.
I love it. Well, Mark, tell us a little bit about your journey to where you are today. From my brief interactions with you, you didn't wake up as a high performer. So you've gone through some things and they've motivated you to become an Ironman, a founder, an author. So give us the kind of abridged version of the story that brought you to where you are, who you are today.
Yeah. For most of my life, it is really just shocking to hear people come up to me and say, "Wow, look how far you've come. Wow, I can't believe that you've done that. Wow, you know, I can't believe that you have time in your day to do this and to do as much as you do, to own a business, to write books, to do Ironman triathlon." And when they say it, honestly, now it is only starting to feel real, right? It's only starting to feel like I'm a high performance person because my self-concept is still shifting. It's only been 5 years that I've been living this life, that I've been walking into this life, might I say, because I can't say that it's you wake up one day and all of a sudden you're doing everything, you know, in a high performance lifestyle type method. You know, there's a lot of errors along the way. There's a lot of finding it out. There's a lot of learning to be had when the decision is made. When my decision was made, it was a life or death decision. So ultimately, my entire life, I had a serious showing up problem. I was not willing to show up for myself. And here's why. Ultimately, I was ashamed of who I was. And if you have an element of shame in you, then it's really hard to show up. And you are not to blame for that, right? You are not to blame that it's hard for you to show up. Now, what I was to blame for that I started to recognize was I was to blame for the willingness. I was to blame for the willingness to be able to show up. And ultimately, that's what a life or death situation brought to me, was a willingness. It almost felt like I was out in the middle of the ocean and drowning, and then all of a sudden, you know, a pelican dropped a life vest and I just grabbed a hold. I was willing to grab a hold of a life vest that was sitting there before me. And that first life vest that was there before me came in a very mysterious way. It was after a suicide attempt, my third in a week, actually, as I had been trying to recover from heroin addiction for about 6 years at this point. I had been diagnosed with COPD. I was in my second marriage that was failing. We were pregnant. I was homosexual, unwilling to come out of the closet. And here I am, just unwilling to show up for myself. And then when I woke up from that suicide attempt, I really didn't know what to do, but I knew that I couldn't go home because I was so ashamed of who I was. And so instead, I was in Whitefish, Montana, and I was like, man, I don't want to go to a coffee shop and sit in there. I'm just going to go to the gym. I'm going to go to the gym where I can hide in the sauna and just sweat and think. And so I went there, but on the way to the sauna, you have to walk by the pool. And since I had just tried to kill myself by jumping into a river, I decided to jump into the pool instead. So I jumped into the pool, felt the water, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to try to swim to the other side. So I tried to swim to the other side. And upon getting to the other side, I was so exhausted that I thought that I was going to die, and I became willing to swim back to the other side. Now, that is becoming willing in the face of great fear of drowning. And experiencing that for myself for the very first time and then making it over to that other side, I had a sense of joy and a sense of empowerment that I had not felt in so many years. The heroin, the drugs, the alcohol, it had robbed me of that sense of accomplishment and being proud in anything that I did. Because, gentlemen, when I would do anything, so when I got my college degree in psychology, I was not proud of it. I was proud of my ability to use Adderall and my Xanax and my drugs to fall asleep. I was an expert in mental chemistry is all I was. And I made it through college, right? But I wasn't proud of anything that I did in my life. And so getting out of that water, I felt proud. And then some man came up to me and said, you should do an Ironman. And I looked at him. I'm 230 pounds. I can barely swim across the pool. And he says this, and I go, you're absolutely crazy. Well, as he's walking by, he goes, if I did it, you can too. And when I heard that, I recognized a sort of challenge inside that was no different than the challenge of which I had just experienced in the pool. It was a little micro challenge inside of the pool, right? But this gave me a big challenge that was going to be 6 months to a year later. And I was like, you know what? If this could give me every day the sense that I had in that pool, then I'm going to give that a try. So I went home. I was currently basically homeless. I was living in an unfinished basement on a mattress pad that was about an inch thick with my ex-wife. It was a queen-size mattress pad. And we were cooking ramen noodles and rice and beans on a hot plate. So I went up to her and said, I'm going to sign up for an Ironman. Ironman's not cheap, right?
No.
The entry ticket, you have to have a bike, you have to have swim stuff. And she said, how on earth are you going to do that? I said, if I can use your credit card, I believe that it's going to be possible. And so we put it on her credit card. I didn't have any money at the time. I didn't even have a bank account. And I signed up for the race and then downloaded a training plan. And I became willing to take a step and to show up for myself the next morning for that training plan. That's it.
So Mark, that's first pretty incredible, right? In that short amount of time that happened, but before this, because, you know, you probably had other moments that didn't break through. So where did you grow up? What was going on then? You know, that sounds like you at least made some decisions that were good. You went to college, you know, you thought maybe a relationship would work, but what happened before that? In leading up that, you know, wasn't working.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we look at back in my life, you have to wonder, you know, when did you start not showing up for yourself, you know? And it was a very, very early age. And it happened sometime around, you know, I can't remember it exactly as happening like the day after. It's more, I think trauma is more like compounded interest in one's life. And so after a traumatic event, so my particular traumatic event was being molested by my cousin, and I was about 6 years old or so. And I remember very shortly after that, my whole concept of self becoming very confused. The concept that I was only a sexual type being, right? And the concept that not only that I was the wrong sexual being. It was just, you know, I began to develop a lot of fear for showing up at all, because if I showed up as the little, so I was born and raised in a Southern Christian Baptist family, very diligent, very strong people, very successful, always very smart. Now, if I showed up to a situation in life as a child, and I was not congruent with that, with what I saw on the outside that I was supposed to be, then it created inside of me a sense of shame and a sense of fear, a sense of reluctance to show up. And so that's ultimately where it started, is going, wait a second, I don't belong here. I remember walking into my elementary school classes and just being like, all the other kids around here know exactly what they're doing today. All of them know exactly where they came from today. I felt like an absolute alien. I felt like I was all alone. I felt like nobody would understand me if I shared, you know, what I felt inside. So I just kind of kept it all inside and started to not show up for myself. And the first place I could do that was mentally, right? So I learned how, and you learn a lot of people who've gone through, especially sexual trauma and violent trauma, interfamily trauma. You know, it's the interfamily trauma where people can literally shut off their brains. They can dissociate. And I remember kids being like, there's one thing you can't ever do, and that's think about nothing. Well, I'll tell you what, I can close my eyes and I can not show up to even my mental landscape, because I had at that time an ability to completely dissociate. And that was my way of not showing up. And ultimately what I learned very early on, about 8 years old or so, was that really what I wanted was just to disappear for good and to die. And I didn't really know that suicide was really a thing, but I knew that I did not like this life. And so what I would do to fall asleep at night is I would choke myself. So about 8 years old, I was choking myself until I fell asleep. And then shortly after that, I also found another way to dissociate, and that was through obsessive compulsive type thinking. And so there comes times when it's almost impossible to dissociate, but during that time, you can actually use practices, and you can use exercises, right, to also avoid and to also escape. And so what I would do is I would start doing things repetitive, and I would walk around my house, and I would open and close drawers. And I mean, I'm talking 9 years old right now, you know, and the way that I was dealing with my fear was now through obsessive compulsive type behaviors. And then once they became, though, very uncomfortable for me, and they would take a lot of time, I started to recognize that, wait a second, I don't think I want to go down this path. And I took ownership of it at one point in my life. And I remember taking the responsibility. I remember being like, you know what? I'm not going to go downstairs and close those. Instead, I'm going to stay inside of my bed right now. And I would stay inside my bed to the point where I was so scared that I would pee my bed. So I had enuresis problems. Wow. until I was about 13 years old, because I was dealing with all these traumas and inabilities. And I would become paralyzed in my bed, unable to move, in absolute terror, until I just urinated. And then very soon, you know, with all that stuff inside, I would learn about sex, and I would then learn about like drugs, and I would have new outlets. Now the curious thing about those outlets is that they provided me a wonderful escape, because what they did for me, unlike the OCD type stuff, is they actually gave me an identity. So what I mean by that is that if I had a girlfriend on my side, then all of a sudden I was a guy with a girlfriend, right? That's my identity. And it protects me from everything that other people might uncover if they know the real me. So I found a key. I found a key that I could use other people. I could use activities that I do. I could use anything to create identities for myself that would block who I actually was. And that's when I really started, you know, getting lost because I started trying on all those identities. You know, I idolized Jim Morrison, for instance. I mean, I did everything that he did. I tried to eat as much acid, right? I mean, everything. Like I did that with all my friends as well. So I really started losing myself. At one point it came to a nail in the head where it was like, he doesn't even know himself anymore. And so now it almost seems for somebody who's going through that type of trauma, there has to be something that breaks them out of all the lies that they have been saying about themselves. And that's why guys, when I opened up my book, and the first paragraph in there, I don't say this book is for those who are trying to come out of the closet. I don't say that this book is for those who are trying to overcome addiction. I don't even say this book is about those who are trying to overcome trauma. I say this book is about, it's for all the liars out there. That this book is for all the liars out there, because it's the lies that I recognize that I was living in, that I was telling myself about myself. Those were the only things causing me to do the stuff that was hurting me and causing me to do the stuff that was hurting other people. And those were the only things that were causing me not to show up for myself.
Yeah. Mark, I want to get into the book in a bit, but I want to backtrack a little bit and use the word identity a few times. And before you even said it, I was thinking about, you know, the transitions you've made in your life through, you know, seeking identity and struggling with that. So I'd love to take one step deeper and hear, you know, the identities that you struggled with, the steps that you've taken in your life to now find your own identity. And frankly, what is your identity today?
Well, I noticed that the method took practice. Okay. So I remember I had an uncle who was able to move his eyebrows really good, right? Move them all around. And I remember being a kid and just being transfixed by that and saying, I want to be a person who can do that. When you're a kid, you know, everything's so simple. And that was his identity to me. So, right, I wanted to have that in my repertoire, in my identity, but I couldn't do it. So what I did is as every night I would lay down and I would use my OCD behavior, right? And I would hold my one eyebrow down and I would move both of them. And you're probably wondering where I'm going at here. I would move both of them and it trained the muscle to start moving solo. And so after a few months, I was able to move my eyebrows. I had become a person who could now be an eyebrow mover. And that was a very elementary example of how I started to try on different identities throughout my life. And ultimately that would come into play as well after I would learn about how wonderful of a method physical training can be to help somebody break out of the false identities and into and see themselves in the true light. Because, you know, no matter how many types of identities or strengths or talents I wanted to add on to myself, moving my eyebrow, finishing college, becoming a psychologist, you know, or becoming a heroin addict or becoming a drug dealer, any of these identities, no matter how much, none of them ended up being fulfilling. So I would try on all these different little hats. I would get all these different little tasks and I would go, or all these different little gifts. And I would go, man, I'm still nothing. I'm still nothing. I still feel like I'm absolutely worthless. And so here's the thing about, you know, searching for the identity that you think that you might want is that no matter what, it's never going to be enough. Like, so I only noticed that a couple of years ago because I was walking around and people are like, man, your body is like perfect. You know, I'm doing swimsuit modeling and people are just like, wow, you know, a triathlete like doesn't always look like that. How did you do that? And I was like, you know what? I have no idea, but I'll tell you what, I don't feel that inside yet. And I didn't feel that inside yet because I still had lies about who I was and what I wanted to be and all of that type of stuff. And until triathlon was able to rip that away, I wasn't able to see myself clearly.
And so you went, this is sort of, I guess, you know, makes a lot of sense. You went from, you know, you were a kid in a family that, you know, everything seemed reasonably good, but you weren't feeling good about yourself. Try these identities. You do what the world thinks you should, which is you go to college. And then after some point, sounds like you got married. And then, you know, that didn't work. And then, you know, throughout this, you were trying these identities. What made you, like, a lot of people never give up on one of them and they stick with them even though they're never that. How come you threw them away and then tried another one?
Because I always came up empty. Mm-hmm. I'm not okay with coming up empty. Mm-hmm. I'm on a treasure hunt in this life, right? And none of those things were helping me to escape the hell that I was in. The hell that I was in was wanting to kill myself every single day. So that's one variable that you guys got to understand, is that every single day of my life, I have thought about dying. Every single day I think about suicide, and it has never left my head. Okay. So, if you think about that and you think, okay, just put yourself in my shoes. I'm 15 years old and every morning I'm thinking maybe I should kill myself today. Well, you're going to try something, right? So you try something and you're like, well, maybe if I grow my hair out long and start smoking pot and listening to the Grateful Dead, that I'm going to find my community and I'm going to wake up one morning and I'm not going to want to kill myself. And so I start trying that, and to the point that where all that ends up happening for me is I want to kill myself more as I get more and more deeply enrooted into these identities that aren't me, that aren't my potential. And so then ultimately I get to a point where I'm like, you know what? This is just too bad. Like, this is not who I am. I'm at a Phish concert right now, butt naked, a mile away from the actual concert in a river, believing that I'm a toad jumping around, lost, cold, you know, miserable, and scared, so scared to go back to my friends who are all having a good time on all these drugs and alcohol, and me just scared in this river, like unable to face who I am. It was just misery. Every identity that I put on was just absolute misery. And so that's why I would shift. Now, the beautiful thing about what that allowed me to do is it did allow me to also be able to recognize, wait a second, this isn't working right now. I'm going to shift. And not only that, I had to maintain a lot of different roles, right? I had to, just like all of us, you have to maintain, you know, the student role, you have to maintain the father role, you have to maintain the work role, the church role, and you're kind of a different person in all of those. And the undulation between those and the transfer between those is a very, very healthy and very natural thing to have. However, when it's a complete dissociation, then it's different. And what a complete dissociation does is basically what I was. Instead of a person in this identity, I was more so a method actor. I was more so an actor with some sort of oculus looking at me all the time that was inside of my mind. And it was like, are you being the right hippie right now? Or are you being the right brother? Are you in school right now? And it was always like I was watching myself, you know? That is no longer there anymore, because there's an assurance that I am myself. And it helps to be able to be more present in that, mm-hmm. because you can listen to people better. You can hear them out for what they're saying and not for what they're saying based on who you are type stuff. There's a lot of very exciting things in that, but I will say, so I want to touch on one very important component that you talked about. And it's like how some people will get stuck trying an identity for the rest of their life. Right. And they'll never end up taking the turn. And this is actually the content that I'm writing about right now for my next book. The title is fairly uncertain, but the topic is alongside the lines of how to become unstuck. Because ultimately what would happen to me in all those scenarios, although they were so much more maybe intense than some other people, because a lot of people in their identities, it doesn't end in them wanting to kill themselves, right? A lot of times it's just, they're just kind of depressed. But because I had that, I had to move. And so I can look back in my life and I can go, how did I become unstuck? What are the little variables? What are the little practices? What's the little things that I would do? The little commitments I would make to myself, like holding my eyebrow down. What are the little things that I can do in order to put on this new identity of myself? The danger of that, the danger of saying, of being in an unhealthy place and saying, I want to move to this new identity that I see out there, is that the eyes of which you're looking through, the goggles of which you're peering out into the world and desiring a new self, is skewed because you're seeing it from the eyes of a very limited perspective. And so it's really hard to see who you're actually supposed to be if your eyes are filled with what I say trauma goggles, right? But we can have trauma goggles for all sorts of things and poor perception and poor view of ourselves. But the trauma goggles have got to come off. And I do believe that Joe, after, you know, reading your book and so many other people out there, you know, there's so many different methods about breaking these trauma goggles that does not involve 10 years of therapy or, you know, going to do ayahuasca or, you know, finding a religion or going to AA. It's much more simple, I do believe. And I do believe that us as humans are moving into a paradigm shift of individual empowerment, where this is going to start to individual empowerment and wellness, where we're going to start to see great leaps and bounds in people overcoming their past traumas with the power being restored within themselves, because they're able to become unstuck from their current spot.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into that. I think this is a great opportunity to hear some of your thoughts, some of the things that maybe you wrote about in your first book or writing about in your newest book. But it, as you've talked about this in your life, and as you talk to other people that maybe are struggling to take off their trauma goggles, what are those conversations like? What recommendations, advice, tips, tricks, thoughts do you have for somebody that is at least aware that they need to make a change, but have no idea what's that first step I need to take? Where should I go? What resources are available? Pull from your vast wealth and experience and just give some advice.
Yeah, well, the first step actually takes no effort. That's the thing that people often are misguided by. It doesn't take effort. It doesn't, for me, it didn't take any effort. It didn't take yelling at myself saying, you're a piece of crap. Do the next pull up. You can do it. Run this mile. You've got to get out of bed. Like, it didn't take that. It also didn't take me, you know, finding a system of support. Like all of those things will come into play a little bit later on. But the very first thing actually that happened is a surrendering. The very first thing that happened is when I recognized that my suicide attempt was really just a expression of how darn good I am at giving in and giving up. And now, I love things that are contrary and ironic and opposites. And when giving up can send you into a place where you get everything that you ever dreamed of, you know, that's a beautiful thing to me. Giving up, guys, giving up to me is just acceptance. It's accepting, you know, what I have in front of us. And for me, all that was falling into the pool that morning. All I had to do was fall into the pool. That there was nothing else, right? So that first day of training, I looked at the schedule and I go, there's no way that I can do this. I've never been able to swim two laps of the pool, care less about 1 mile. And then later on this afternoon, I'm supposed to run like 7 miles. How on earth is anybody supposed to do that? Especially somebody who hasn't taken a step in a running way in at least 15 years. Like, how am I going to do that? Well, the answer was I wasn't going to do it. I was just going to give in to it. So doing it took way too much effort in my head. It's just all about giving up to it.
It's so interesting because I think probably one of the themes that, you know, because we've had other stories of really interesting, you know, I don't know, the word redemption isn't a good word, but it works for people who really struggled, had no hope, and then there was this breakthrough. And in some way, Mark, I think there is a theme that says that we think that it's going to be a lot of external support that does it. I think it's more just this, you know, where we either give up or grow tired of the circumstance and want a different one ourselves.
Yeah.
But you need reinforcement, though, I guess is where I was going to go with this. So that a little bit of success does help you feel better, right? So you swam two lengths of the pool. That was success, right? Even if modest, it said, oh, wow, I'm not just a failure. I can succeed. What do you think about how that plays a role in this?
The view of success is always out of reach for me. And it was then. So, you know, swimming two laps in the pool was actually a miserable failure to me. Mm. And in fact, even finishing an Ironman is still a failure to me. And here's the reason, because I'm always looking at ways to improve. And it's the moments. It's not the completing the entire race. It's not the walking across the finish line. And it's not even the starting of the finish line. It's all the little itty bitty moments in between. That's where the success is. And so doing that swim, it wasn't about making it across one lap or making it across the other. It was only about the fact that I did something that I believed that I couldn't do. My entire life was an I can't read that. Guys, I couldn't read until I was in fourth grade. Okay. Because I couldn't pay attention, right? I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. And immediately what happened when I started to train for Ironman and start to, you know, slowly get through my very first training episode. Let's break it down. Not even thinking about my first day, my very first training episode, within 5 minutes of it, I'm starting to say, I can. Even beyond 5 minutes, 10 seconds into my first swim, when I jumped into that pool, I just said, I can. You know, so I break it down into all these little manageable moments, and that is where the magic happens. Success then becomes obsolete.
Sure.
Do you find that success, you've gotten the ball rolling? Is it, you know, you've had a past with addiction, right? Do you find that your success, your training, and these new things you're accomplishing are kind of a new sort of addiction, and you're driving to that next, you know, accomplishment as a high? Or is there any relation? And I ask that because it seems like a lot of ex-addicts find their way to, you know, creating businesses, endurance sports, and things like that. And I'm just kind of curious on your take on why that is and what your feeling is of going from, yeah, you know, heroin to now high achiever.
Yeah, this is a wonderful topic. We could probably spend the whole podcast on this, but you know, chasing a high is if you're getting into running to chase a high, then you're going to enter a lot of hard times, because it's not that to me. Because so addiction is about escaping, right? Mm-hmm. Addiction is about running away. Addiction isn't about getting high. It's not about chasing a high. For me, for my life, there are addicts out there. There are people out there who had a lot of fun doing that stuff. For me, though, I remember I was trying to choke myself out. I was trying to dissociate. I was trying to leave anything that was normal. So as it pertains to the highs that are achieved throughout training and throughout triathlon, so when I start to experience what they call the runner's high, when I also, I get it a lot in the pool, and I get it a lot when I'm extremely exhausted during races, I'll get to the point where it's this weird feeling that reminds me a lot of the sublime bliss that heroin used to take me. And when I enter that, it's not a good feeling. Okay. Mm-hmm. I actually don't like the highs, and I don't like the lows of this sport whatsoever. And I'm working with my counselor right now to really learn how to appreciate and experience the highs and experience the lows. But at this point, I'll tell you that, you know, the actual chemical that goes on inside the brain when it does, it still kind of scares me a little bit because it's so intense and it floods and it is such a beautiful thing. But I don't run for that. I don't run for that. And here's why and how I started to do my triathlon training. Well, I signed up for my Ironman, and probably about 3 weeks into it, I began to get obsessive about my training. I began to get obsessive about my training to the point that if my ex-wife got in the way of my training, I would yell at her. I would get mad at her. I was becoming unhealthy with it. I was it was starting to ruin my life, right? So since it was starting to ruin my life, I started to recognize, wait a second, this is just becoming another addiction. I am actually running away from all of my problems, and I'm running at the gym instead. And what ended up happening to me is my performance started to depreciate. So I started to get injured because I was running on the wrong type of fuel. I was running on this fuel that was actually brewing inside of me a whole bunch of negative resentment and stuff that wasn't helping aiding in my performance. So for instance, I would get in an argument with my wife and I would go run angry. Well, if I run angry, I run at a 15-minute pace of just pure misery where I'm not happy at all. And there's definitely no runner's high. Now, if I deal with the thing that was bothering me before I go for my run, then I'm free and I can run a 7-minute mile barely huffing and puffing. So what is that? That's not addiction. That's actually a vehicle to deal with my issues, a reason and a focus to deal with everything in my life. So for instance, the reason why I eat healthy is because I have the focus of performance. The reason why I wake up early and I do my meditation first thing in the morning is not for some high or some glorious feeling. It's because it increases my performance. It gives me a focus. The reason why I run, the reason why I train is not to go find a high daily. It's the focus of my life. And the reason why I race now, the reason why I race now is not to display my triumph or to, you know, or to prove to myself that I'm worthy or something like that, like it would be, I think, if I was in active addiction. Instead, the reason why I race is a celebration of life. And that, all of that is a complete opposite of addiction, every aspect of it.
Yeah. And, you know, if you listen to this and you think about, well, there's quite a few years that went by where all of these episodes happened and there's sometimes where you tried something and then there's another time where it worked, it didn't work. There's some consistency in the failure. There's this reframing that goes on. But then you get to this point in the recent past where, and please, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, you tried a lot of different approaches, you know? You tried drugs, yeah. You tried hiding, you tried getting married, you tried, you know, all of this.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and so then what happens then? Like, why the, now you're not trying as much, you're now living versus trying on this identity thing.
Yeah. And ultimately it was the perfect storm at the perfect time. Right. And I believe everybody out there has who's struggling in a spot like I was, they also have a storm and a perfect time. It's just around the corner if they're willing to open up to it. The storm that I had to enter was going to be triathlon, and it was the inner fight that I would go through to get to my training every morning was no different from the inner fight that a lot of other addicts would go through to get themselves to an AA or NA meeting, right? It was a lot of the stuff that I was starting to learn in triathlon was the exact same as the stuff that I was learning in, or had been trying to learn my whole life in AA or Narcotics Anonymous. And so I started to recognize that, wait a second, this was my language. This was like what I was born to hear, right? Yeah. I wasn't born to hear the stuff in this AA group where they're, you know, sitting around eating donuts and stuff. I was born to hear a different thing. And not only that, there, for me, I think that anything that I tried on that was not complete, right? So triathlon can be complete. AA religion, it's a spiritual component. To me, it's not complete. It doesn't involve the mind and it doesn't involve the body. And until I had something that connected my mind, body, and my spirit all together, I was just going to be floundering around looking for the right thing, right? That's why just doing yoga didn't work for me. It wasn't enough, right? I had tried that in sobriety and it just, I would be sober for a few months and I would be doing all my yoga. It just wasn't enough to really break through. And here's a curious thing that I talked about with my mom actually on this trip was that she remembers finding a psychologist who could finally work with me. And this woman, I do talk about her a little bit in my book, but she would put me on a treadmill. At like 8 years old, put me on a treadmill in order to talk to her. So what was known about me as a human being, the way that I operate, the way that I work, is that I have to be going through exercise and movement. I have to be connecting my mind and my body and my spirit in order to be able to have any sort of clarity in sort of a therapeutic relationship. And if that's the case, if I'm hiding myself, unless I am being physically active, then I need something that's going to physically kind of break away the scales of what I think about myself. And that's ultimately what triathlon does every single day, is I believe that I can't. I wake up with this vision of this person that you don't see here, right? That I don't see in the mirror. It's this whole other like ugly Quasimodo person. And then by the end of my, who can't even go for a jog, right? And then at the very beginning of my jog, I'm starting to straighten up my back and starting to get a smile on my face. The Quasimodo, the scales disappear. The scales fall off of me in the course of a training episode. And then I emerge the man who I was meant to be, the same man who my psychologist saw many years ago, the same boy who could be a natural leader, who had a whole bunch of joy, who could tell the truth, right? Who could be honest about who he was. I can be that now because I have that tool, right?
Mark, I want to I want to backtrack just a little bit and get back into the suicide topic, specifically within the LGBTQ community, right? That community is three times more likely to attempt suicide. And my curiosity for you is, why is that? First of all, I know you have some firsthand experience on that, but then secondarily, what needs to change in the world to improve that? I asked this question, one, because it's very important, but two, this is the last day of Pride Month, right? It'd be a shame for us not to at least address that community does face suicide more regularly than the straight community. So take a moment, address that. And then also from an ally standpoint, what can allies do to their LGBTQ friends and family to help with that issue?
Yeah, I'm really happy that you bring this up. In my personal experience and my story, what had happened was, you know, I wrote my book and I had not come out of the closet to my parents. My parents are the epitome, or were the epitome of homophobic. I was the epitome of homophobic. If I walked to an elevator and saw two gay guys in there, I would not get in it. I would have waited for the next one. Okay. So I knew when I was about to come out of the closet that I was going to be battling up against what I believed to be hate towards me. I believed that my parents hated me because they hated other gays, right? Not only that, I believe that every homophobe out there hated me. The idea and the concept that the world hates me is, in essence, going to cause a lot of problems in an individual, because when a person feels that they're cornered up against a wall with an animal who's standing there that hates them, then they are going to start scratching and peeling and screaming and doing whatever they can to get out of that corner. And that's kind of what I see the LGBTQ community in right now. They believe that the world is all out to get them, that they hate them, that everybody is just mad at them, and that they're that the only love that they can have is inside of their community. That, my friends, is the greatest fallacy that we are currently living under on this planet. And it's not only with the LGBTQ community, that's with Republicans and Democrats as well. Now, see, and that's with Lutherans and Catholics. It's the essence of the problem of what we have. We all believe that we kind of hate each other, and that's not the truth. And the truth is that hate, actually, in my experience, hate does not exist. Hate is just the absence of love. And I believe that in the absence of love, there is a very easy solution. There is absolutely no solution to hate, by the way. No solution. There's no way you're going to change somebody's opinion. There's no, and if that opinion is the definition of hate, there's no way that you're going to change that. But if you view life as an absence, as just a simple absence of love, then all you have to do is turn up the dial of love a little bit. And love is something that you can control 100% within you. So here's how this worked for me. When I was finishing up my book and thinking about going into public speaking, I was introduced to an author named Dale Carnegie. Dale Carnegie wrote this book called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And inside of that book, it talks all about how to approach somebody who disagrees with you vehemently, somebody who otherwise hates all of your theories and everything that you believe in. How do you win that person over and leave the room and become friends with them? That is a great mystery, guys. If we can do that, then we can save this world, right? Then we can change the conversation that we're having between the LGBTQ community and the non-LGBTQ community, the Democrats and the Republicans, and all the differences that we see. And so one of the things that I remember speaking so loudly from him was the fact that you need to take time to get to know the fear that is causing the absence of love in your adversary. In order to get to understand the fear that they have, you know, because what happens when I go up to my father, who is homophobic, is all of a sudden I've instilled fear inside of him. So what I need to do is I need to go in and I need to understand that fear. This is what the Buddhists call suffering with. This is what Jesus Christ calls picking up the cross of your friends and neighbors, right? This is what the triathlete does at the end of the race when he goes up to the next person and says, run with me, because I can't do this alone. I can't do this alone. You are so different than me, but run with me. I need it right now. I need to understand the pain that you're feeling so that I can transcend the pain that I'm in right now. So what I did is I went up to my dad and I asked them what was going on with their fears. And I said, guys, I am scared of myself too. I am so scared of being gay. I recognize this fear that you have of me because I have it too. And once I was able to come into that circle and say, I have the same fear of this as you do, at least an element of it, right? Then it became a team. And then the absence of love began to dissipate, right? Instead, we began to go, okay, what are some commonalities? What are some solutions that we can arrive at? And what we ended up doing, we watched some movies, right? We watched one movie in particular that had one of my first loves in high school, who he passed away. He was helping me to come out of the closet, and he passed away on some drugs that we were sharing. And the fact that I had lived and he had died, you know, that brought to my parents a new element of which they were able to combat their own absence of love or their own ideologies that reflected hate, right? And so ultimately what that did is it brought us closer together. Now, was there still a lot of learning to do? Yes, but there wasn't any sort of anger, right? Because where there is love, there is no room for it. Where there is light, there is no room for darkness, right? Light does cast a shadow. There's a shadow looming all the time. It's there, right? And we don't have to be scared of that anymore, because here's what we know how to do now. I know how to traverse the light. I know how to traverse into the light with the person who otherwise hates me, who otherwise sees me as darkness. I know how to find lightness with them and walk in that light with them. And ultimately, guys, that's what I believe that we as in the LGBTQ community need to start recognizing, is that everyone's not out to get us. The world is not inherently bad. People are not so mean. There are so many good people out there. And all the very evil people are actually very, very capable of a tremendous amount of good. But all we have to do is recognize that we're all in this together. We're all suffering together. And through that, then we're able to find compassion for each other. And when we can find compassion for each other and compassion for ourselves, our limit, we become limitless. We become limitless. No amount of suffering is too much suffering that you can't go through when you have compassion on your side. And both of you guys, as triathletes, as endurance athletes, know this. When you are at the very wit's end of the strongest struggle that you've ever had in your life, and then you're compassionate towards yourself, or you have somebody come up and encourage you with compassion, all of a sudden you get another burst of wind. That's all we need to do to each other, you know, is recognize that we're all in this together.
Yeah, I think... listening to you is, you know, very encouraging, because there's so many aspects of this, which is, you know, one, you didn't know this before, but you figured it out. Number two, you're living it, which is great. Number three, you're able to articulate it so that others can benefit from that. No matter where we are in the struggle, there really isn't an end. You know, back Albert Camus wrote this line. I always remember that suicide is not an adequate response to the problem at hand. And, you know, it is, it never solves anything. And you figured out, and I'm sure there's lots still to learn, you know, as you go along on this journey. Are you excited about the future? How do you feel about what's next, given all you've been through?
I'm so excited about today. I am honestly just so excited about today. As it pertains to the future, the only thing that I'm excited about is the fact that I know it's going to work out. But now, as it pertains to suicide, I recognize that I didn't really touch on that. And the reason is because it's almost obsolete. You know, once you recognize, once you tap into the love of life and the good of life, you know, suicide, it really, for me, it just kind of disappears. Okay. So when it starts coming back up in my life and I start thinking maybe it's time to commit suicide, I recognize what it is I've isolated myself. I've become lonely. I begin to think that the whole world is out to get me. I begin to think that I'm all alone and that the only solution is suicide. So the answer to that is to tap in, right? Is to tap in, and not necessarily to tap into the insular community that I'm in, but I need to prove to myself that good is out there, that love is out there, even in the community that might not be my closest people. But as it pertains to thoughts of suicide, I really do like to share with people that if you have thoughts with suicide, then maybe a suicide is exactly what you need. And oftentimes the things that are going on inside of us are just a reflection, and the mirror of the outside, the physical solution may seem like it's actually pulling a trigger or it's actually killing yourself. But inside, you have a solution always that's so much easier. And you can actually just kill the person that you've become, and you can step into the person who you've been born to be. And that's how I close my book out, is it's my suicide race. Like, I stepped into the person who I was born to be, and I had killed the person who I was trying to kill all along. But so that's what I like to share with people who are actively contemplating suicide, is man, just be willing to take a step into a person, into a thing, into an action that you're so not used to doing that it is almost like you're committing suicide. And that could be going out and trying a piece of sushi. Just try something new. Do something that puts you uncomfortable, something that challenges your comfort, and emerge from the other side victorious. That's it. In that moment, you're going to witness the magic of transcendence.
Yeah, that's amazing, Mark. Thank you so much. I feel like we could just keep talking for hours and hours and hours, but thank you so much for being vulnerable, sharing your story, sharing these thoughts with us and our community. We will absolutely have you back after soon. And then after this next book comes out, let's get you back on and talk more about that book. But thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Mark, you're
too. Thank you.
A great role model for lots of people. So keep going.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate that. And I'll stay true.